This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Newslink.
Hello, welcome to Newslink. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn, Germany. Coming up on the program, we'll hear how an EU press conference, ordinarily a bland bit of political theater, right, may have inadvertently tipped off the power struggle at the heart of Europe's slow response to the debt crisis. We'll also hear about a new chapter in the story of a monument to Woodrow Wilson in Prague.
Now, this monument stood proudly at this very site until the Nazis came into Prague and in the middle of the night destroyed the statue.
What do you know? They've put it back up. We'll bring you those stories and more coming up on Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. Let's get started. European Commission President Jose Manuel Barroso met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Brussels this Wednesday. The two leaders discussed what could be done to help Greece and to bolster banks in the Eurozone exposed to Greek debt, even potential changes to how the EU is run. And as Christoph Hasselbach reports from Brussels, many came away feeling that the meeting framed Europe's current leadership struggle well. On the one hand, the administrative superstructure that is the European Commission. On the other, the Union's largest and most robust economy, Germany, who everyone hopes will write the checks.
EU Commission President José Manuel Barroso went out of his way to flatter the German Chancellor, or more precisely, flatter her country.
With its ambitious structural reforms enacted early and its determination to maintain sound public finances, Germany has in many areas shown the way. It has been rewarded with high levels of competitiveness, growth and low level of unemployment that are the envy of many other countries.
Structural reforms and creating solid public finances are exactly what Barroso and Merkel are asking of Greece now. But economic news from Greece is getting worse and worse, and people are now talking openly about a possible default. Merkel admitted indirectly that forecasts made at a special summit about Greece in July had been too optimistic. Now we'll have to see whether Greece's current economic data are still compatible with the summit's decisions, and also whether these decisions now have to be adapted, including the contribution of private creditors. Greece must stay in the euro area and it must have the chance to get back on its feet. But difficult as the present situation may be, the Chancellor is already looking into the future for ways to prevent a new debt crisis. In her thinking, it is critical that euro members accept the need for more economic cooperation and solidity. She calls this economic governance. And if we come to the conclusion that we don't have the necessary rights to enforce this, we'll have to think about changing the EU Charter. This shouldn't be a taboo. But given that the Lisbon Treaty took years of quarrel to implement, there is little appetite in Europe for another slog toward a new constitution. And there is another problem. While Merkel and the French President Nicolas Sarkozy want economic governance to be a matter between member states, Barroso insists the Commission must play a central role.
On matters of union competence, those matters that were already transferred to the European Union, the Commission is the economic government of Europe. We must avoid parallel and coordinated processes in the future.
In other words, Merkel's and Barroso's joint press conference was anything but a show of unity, rather a demonstration of the power struggle between the Commission and the most powerful country in the EU. Christoph Hasselbach, Deutsche Welle Radio, Brussels.
Elsewhere in the troubled eurozone, the ratings agency Moody's has downgraded Italy's sovereign debt rating by 3 points. Moody's cited lack of confidence in the country's economy as the reason and forecast a negative outlook. As Megan Williams reports from Rome, the move couldn't have come at a worse time.
As if Italy didn't have enough problems. High unemployment, a mammoth debt, a no-growth economy, and a leader more focused on his legal troubles than guiding the economy.
La scelta di Moody's era attesa. Il governo italiano
now sta Italians have woken up to the news that their country's credit rating was downgraded from AA2 to A2 and given a negative outlook by Moody's. The agency says it's doing this because of, in its words, sustained and non-cyclical erosion of confidence. As a result, Italy's already dangerously high borrowing costs to help pay off its debt will likely rise, and that will put the finances of Italy and Europe in further jeopardy. It's the second downgrade for Italy in less than a month. Moody's rival Standard & Poor's also cut the country's credit rating, prompting the European Central Bank to buy up billions of euros worth of Italian bonds in order to keep their interest rate down. Italian Prime Minister Berlusconi blamed that downgrade on a media campaign against him. This one, he said, was expected. Experts say as a result of the latest credit rating cut, Italy's large and traditionally stable banks will likely find it harder and more costly to borrow. Banks are seen to be only as strong as the governments that stand behind them. And in Italy's case, the Berlusconi-led government is considered increasingly weak and fractured. Italian politics professor Roberto Dallemonte says the downgrade isn't the only sign of lack of confidence in the government. So too is the country's leading business lobbying group taking a distance.
And in the last few weeks, the head of the Confindustria has consistently criticized the government for inaction, for not having fulfilled the promises that it was voted in for. And this has been very consistent, very loud, very critical, which to me means that this important segment of the Berlusconi coalition has decided to turn against him.
Dallemonte says Berlusconi did not take seriously Italy's crippling debt of more than twice the country's GDP until too late. As a result, he failed to make changes that would have led to desperately needed growth in the economy.
He has not liberalized, as he had promised to do, and he has not privatized. There is still a large amount of public economy left in this country. There's still companies that should go private, like the one that produces big ships, cruise ships. There's another company, Finmeccanica, that produces helicopters, among other things. We have city governments owning company producing milk. All of these should be privatized and, where is possible, liberalized. This has not occurred under this government.
Ironically, the strongest, albeit indirect, criticism of Berlusconi's handling of the economy comes from his finance minister, Giuliano Tremonti. When asked why countries in similar economic trouble weren't downgraded, Tremonti said,
It depends anche dall'annuncio di elezioni.
The difference between Spain and Italy is that in Spain they have announced elections, which shows an openness to change and a future. Elections that, if held in Italy today, polls show would likely usher out this government. Megan Williams, Deutsche Welle Radio, Rome.
Meanwhile, in Britain, the ruling Conservatives see the debt crisis in the Eurozone as a warning that their country must continue to practice budgetary austerity. In a party conference speech, Prime Minister David Cameron painted an optimistic picture of Britain's prospects. However, he was speaking on a day that brought some bad news for the British economy, as Catherine Drew reports.
It was a tricky speech for David Cameron on a day when GDP figures for the second quarter showed economic growth had come to almost a standstill, dropping to 0.1%. It was the Prime Minister's job to give everyone confidence when many observers fear the country could be on track for a double-dip recession.
I know how tough things are. I don't for one minute underestimate how worried people feel. But the truth is, right now, we need to be energised, not paralysed by gloom and fear. Half the world is booming. Let's go and sell to them. So many of our communities are thriving. Let's make the rest just like them. There is so much that is great about our country. We don't have to accept that success in this century automatically belongs to others.
Mr. Cameron did not dwell at length on the euro debt crisis, but reiterated the tough line the Conservatives have been taking.
As long as I am Prime Minister, this country will never join the euro. And I won't let us be sucked into endless bailouts of countries that are in the euro either.
Indeed, the troubles experienced by Greece, Italy and other EU members serves to illustrate that Britain is on the right course with its severe spending cuts, according to the Conservatives, despite criticism from the Labour Party and some economists that the cuts are too severe and could prompt a return to recession. A Eurosceptic theme was present earlier in the day when Foreign Secretary William Hague reminded the conference of remarks he made at the start of European monetary integration.
14 years ago, I predicted the Eurozone would become a burning building with no exits. But because the Eurozone countries are our friends and neighbours, and because our prosperity and financial stability is tied to theirs, we must now support them in their efforts to quench the flames.
I think there's little doubt that many people on the far right of the, on the right wing of the Conservative Party, who were always sceptical of EU membership, are using the euro crisis to bolster their cause, if you like.
Simon Tilford, chief economist at the Centre for European Reform in London, admits pro-European feeling in the UK is low and notes those on the right of the Conservative Party are grasping the opportunity to argue for a withdrawal from Europe. However, he says the party leadership should not allow the right to dominate the handling of the crisis.
I don't think the time is right to be raising issues of membership. I think that would be interpreted, rightly or wrongly, as a rather unhelpful, even aggressive move by the rest of Europe at this juncture.
So Mr. Cameron and Hague have set out their willingness to help Europe deal with the crisis at a time when they've also signalled to the Eurosceptics in the party that Britain's future relationship with Europe will be far more cautious post-debt crisis. Catherine Drew, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
News and information from the heart of Europe. Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm your host, Matt Herman, in Bonn. NATO defense ministers say alliance military forces will continue to patrol Libya for as long as necessary. At their meeting in Brussels, they had been expected to announce a pullout date. Instead, the gathering was overshadowed by concerns about a shortfall in military capabilities and cuts to defense budgets. The United States is warning that that could pose an existential threat to NATO. Vanessa Mock reports.
NATO is in a self-congratulatory mood. Its mission in Libya is nearly at an end and it's been largely successful. It's carried out over 25,000 air missions and strikes over the past 6 months, which have helped to destroy the Gaddafi regime. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen.
We have saved countless lives and helped the Libyan people to take their destiny in their own hands and out of the grip of Colonel Gaddafi.
The mission in Libya was touted as the first European-led operation of its kind, but it very nearly failed if it hadn't been for the United States.
NATO had a significant shortage, and the United States had to make up that difference.
U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta.
But nowhere were the gaps more obvious than in the critical enabling capabilities, refueling tankers, the provision of intelligence, surveillance. Without these capabilities, the Libya operation would have had a very difficult time getting off the ground or being sustained.
The newly appointed successor to Robert Gates warned that the U.S. could not be relied on in future to come up with the goods. U.S. defense spending could be slashed by $1 trillion over the next decade. And if Europeans don't start pulling their weight, NATO's future could be at stake.
Here in Europe, defense spending has dropped almost 2% annually for a decade. At a time when many European nations have been conducting operations in Afghanistan, Libya, Kosovo, and elsewhere. There are legitimate questions about whether, if present trends continue, NATO will again be able to sustain the kind of operations that we have seen in Libya and Afghanistan without the United States taking on even more of the burden.
But with the Eurozone crisis raging, there's little hope of governments here pouring more money into defence. For now, everyone's focused on getting out of Libya. But confounding expectations, NATO's Secretary-General Anders Fogh Rasmussen didn't set a date.
We will continue our mission for as long as necessary, but we are determined to bring it to an end as soon as possible.
Jan Techau is the director of the think tank Carnegie Europe.
I think it would have been a foolish thing to issue such kind of a date. I think it's very much clear still that the situation is not entirely resolved on the ground. Fighting is still going on. Gaddafi has not been found yet.
The mission in Libya also sparked a rift between NATO allies, with Germany voting against it. The cracks run deep.
No, I don't think they have been papered over. It's very smart not to play them out publicly, but the pressure on the Germans specifically, but also on some other nations that, you know, were reluctant to embark on this, was very, very high. And the Germans already have backpedaled and have tried to engage in damage control within NATO.
NATO allies are now looking for new ways to pool resources, but progress is slow, and failure could undermine future NATO missions. Vanessa Mock, Deutsche Welle Radio, Brussels.
U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta spent 24 hours in Egypt, and he left that country without securing the freedom of a young American, Ilan Grapel, who'd been jailed for 4 months on suspicion of spying for Israel. The Jewish state denies that Grapel, a dual citizen, was a spy. As Iris Makel reports from Jerusalem, the conflict is just one of a number of signs of souring relations between Egypt and Israel.
Israeli authorities describe American law student Ilan Grapel as a dreamer and definitely not a spy. But they concede that if the 27-year-old was depending on the good relations between Israel and Egypt for his release, he'd be languishing in an Egyptian jail for years.
I think that having spoken to this young man, Ilan Grapel, a few minutes, they probably understood that he was not a spy. But they had not the guts to say to their people, like, okay, it was a mistake, sorry.
Tzvi Mazel is a former Israeli ambassador to Egypt. He had good experiences there over 8 years, but says the relationship has declined since the revolution that forced Hosni Mubarak from office earlier this year. Mazel was disturbed by two attacks this summer on the Israeli embassy in Cairo where he'd worked. In the first attack in August, a young man climbed up the building and tore down and burnt the Israeli flag, instantly becoming a national hero, nicknamed Egypt's Spider-Man. In the next attack 3 weeks later, some 4,000 people rammed the security wall and broke into the embassy itself. Tzvi Mazel again.
Till now, nobody can understand it. Nobody can understand it. You know, I have an experience of many, many demonstrations against Israel in Egypt. But at that time, they used to be stopped 400 meters or 500 meters away from the embassy because the government, the police, did not want to lose control.
The ambassador was absent during the break-in, but there were six Israeli guards inside the embassy. Israel's prime minister contacted the Egyptian military, including transitional leader Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi, but nothing happened. It took the personal intervention of American President Barack Obama to get action. Tantawi sent in Egyptian commandos to save the Israelis.
It's bad, it's bad. It means that the country is not ruled as it should have been ruled. It's difficult time for Egypt, I understand very well, and the army is not prepared to rule the country. But still, I mean, we expect some responsible thinking and actions from this government.
After this attack, the editor of Germany's Die Zeit newspaper wrote an article saying that he and other Western journalists had been wrong about the Arab Spring. Joseph Joffe said they were optimistic because no American or Israeli flags were burnt in Tahrir Square. But now Joffe believes it was a false dawn. The old demons are back, he writes, and presumably they never left. Mazel agrees with that. He argues that another concern is the brewing confrontation between Islamic and secular forces across the Arab world, since often their only common denominator is enmity towards Israel. The peace deal between Israel and Egypt has lasted more than 3 decades. If it's to survive, both sides will have to fight to preserve it. Iris Mackler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Jerusalem.
dwworld.de, Deutsche Welle's internet website. We bring you news and views from a European perspective. You'll find information about current affairs, business and economics, culture and lifestyle. You can even learn German with our online German courses. And of course, we bring you the latest program details for DW TV and DW Radio. Deutsche Welle on the internet at dwworld.de.
Around the world, around the clock, news and perspectives from the heart of Europe on DW TV, Deutsche Welle Radio, and online too at dwworld.de. You are listening to Newslink. My name is Matt Herman. A replica of a bronze statue of the former U.S. President Woodrow Wilson has been unveiled in the Czech capital Prague, 70 years since the original was torn down by the Nazis. The Czechs owe a historical debt of gratitude to Wilson and his commitment to self-determination for the nations of Central Europe. Perhaps without Wilson, an independent Czechoslovakia might never have been born. Rob Cameron reports from Prague.
A Czech military band plays a fanfare as the 3-meter bronze statue of Woodrow Wilson, his hands raised in a gesture of blessing, is unveiled in front of Prague's main station. The original statue was taken from an image of Wilson at the 1919 Versailles Peace Conference, which bestowed legitimacy on the nascent state of Czechoslovakia, born out of the ashes of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Fred Malek is the head of the American Friends of the Czech Republic, which funded and oversaw the project.
Now, this monument stood proudly at this very site for some 14 years until the Nazis came into Prague and in the middle of the night destroyed the statue, one of the few monuments or statues in all of Prague that they chose to destroy.
The dignitaries included President Václav Klaus, his predecessor Václav Havel, and also the former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who spoke to the crowd of some 500 people in her native Czech, a language she's not forgotten since her family fled Prague on the eve of the Nazi invasion. It was, in fact, the Nazi governor of Bohemia and Moravia, Reinhard Heydrich, the architect of the final solution, who ordered Wilson's statue to be torn down and melted down for bullets for the German Wehrmacht.
Much of the damage that the Nazis caused can never be undone, but returning the monument of Woodrow Wilson to its proper place is a direct reply to Hitler and to Heydrich. Those men have long since been vanquished, but the ideals of Wilson, like the spirit of Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk, are still alive and flourishing.
Older Czechs still refer to Wilson Station rather than the main station, its current name. The mayor of Prague spoke of his wish that the station return to its original name. It was the Nazis who renamed it, and the communists were in no rush to celebrate a champion of Western humanist ideas. But here in a small park in the centre of Prague, he is remembered, by Czechs at least, and one of his quotations has been set down for posterity. The world must be made safe for democracy. Rob Cameron, Deutsche Welle Radio, Prague.
For more news and information from the heart of Europe, visit our website, dwworld.de. There you'll find the latest news updates, as well as podcasts of many Deutsche Welle Radio programs. With a uniquely European perspective on the events of the day, you're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio's Newslink from Bonn, Germany. My name is Matt Herman. You're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio's Newslink. I'm Matt Herman. Coming up on the next 30 minutes of Newslink, Turkey is conducting a crackdown on Kurdish separatists with ties to the outlawed group, the PKK, and some say that they're going too far.
If you see legal members of a legal party as accomplices to an armed activity, there's not, as I said, not much way out for you as the judiciary of this country or as the government of this country.
We'll have that story in a few minutes, but first, with the campaign for Russia's December parliamentary elections about to begin, opposition groups who are not represented in parliament have called for a boycott of those elections. Representatives of those parties signed an agreement on Wednesday calling on voters not to go to the polls and to have their names removed from voting rolls in an effort to prevent election fraud. But despite sharing a common goal, ending the rule of Prime Minister Vladimir Putin and his entourage, the opposition remains divided on the best way to bring it any closer. Gerhard Korkamp reports from Moscow.
With 2 months to go until the elections for Russia's lower house of parliament, the Duma, the country's Central Electoral Commission has begun registering the parties which are going to take part. At the moment, only 7 parties are officially recognized in Russia, and just 4 of them are represented in parliament. Their Duma presence gives them the right to simply register and start their election campaign. Not so for the remaining 3. They will have to clear one formidable hurdle. Within 2 weeks, they must present 150,000 signatures in support of their participation. And even if they manage to do so and the signatures are declared valid, their chances to enter the next parliament are slim. Various opinion polls show that only 3 parties are likely to get enough votes for representation in the next Duma, and United Russia is expected to gain an outright majority. But there is yet another contingent made up of political groups which have never been officially registered. They are the sworn enemies of Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. Some, including former world chess champion Garry Kasparov, now call for a boycott. Above all, we must make clear what we think of this regime, he says. We don't take part, we don't participate, not on the 4th of December, not on the 2nd of March in the presidential elections. It's a well-considered decision to refrain from any cooperation with the existing power structures. Kasparov and representatives of several other opposition groups signed a declaration on Wednesday calling for a boycott of the elections. But not all opposition leaders like the idea of simply sitting out. The popular blogger Alexei Navalny, a vociferous critic of the Kremlin, told an opposition conference over the weekend that any boycott announced by a relatively small opposition group is counterproductive and does nothing to harm Putin or his party at all. Instead, he argues, it will mean the loss of valuable votes for those parties who oppose Putin and do have a real chance to make it into the Duma, like the left-liberal Yabloko party. I'm not calling on you now to support them or the communists, he said. But they are there. They have tens of thousands of members and millions of supporters. That's a fact. They're afraid to say the things we are saying, and there lies our task. We must help them in order to enhance their chances to get into parliament. And this will mean a new form of political struggle, in which we are all joining forces to fight them. And by them, Navalny, of course, means the most powerful men in Russia, Vladimir Putin and his inner circle, who have been in power for more than a decade and don't seem inclined to give it up any time soon. Gerhard Kuhkamp, Deutsche Welle Radio, Moscow.
Election fever is running high in France as well, of course, where the news weekly L'Express, citing multiple sources, says police intelligence operatives were requested in February to compile a profile of the girlfriend of Nicolas Sarkozy's main rival for the presidency, François Hollande. If substantiated, this would represent an illegal use of the Secret Services and a major scandal. From Paris, John Lawrenson reports.
A few months ago, former socialist Prime Minister Laurent Fabius laughed at the idea that his Parti Socialiste brother, François Hollande, might become president of France. didn't just laugh at it, he poo-pooed it. Since then, Hollande has gone from strength to strength in the opinion polls and is now tipped to beat his rivals and become the socialist presidential candidate and go on to become the next president. The amiable, round-cheeked, bespectacled François Hollande, with his air of a startled owl, is an unlikely-looking political winning machine. And, as the French are now finding out, he's also a bit of a dark horse when it comes to the ladies. Once best known as the partner of the last socialist presidential candidate, the glamorous Ségolène Royal, the media is now full of photos of his current girlfriend, a similarly blessed political TV programme presenter called Valérie Trier-Villers, because, says L'Express, the government ordered the secret police to investigate her past and her connections. François Hollande.
Si ce que dit L'Express est vérifié et confirmé.
If what L'Express says is checked and confirmed, it would be extremely serious, he told France Info Radio, because this is a totally illegal practice. The Interior Minister or the government can't have an information system on people, especially journalists such as Valérie Trier-Villers. So this wouldn't only be an infringement of a moral code, but of the law, and demands, therefore, legal sanction against those who ordered this investigation. The suspicion, of course, is that the presidential palace was seeking to uncover information about Trier-Villers that might be an embarrassment to her boyfriend. It's not the first time the presidential palace has been accused of dirty tricks. Another socialist presidential hopeful, Martine Aubry, has been the victim of persistent, apparently totally unfounded rumours that she is an alcoholic, that she is a lesbian, and that she has a brain tumour. Though personal attacks of this nature are difficult to attribute, as they're usually made by bloggers using pseudonyms. And as far as François Hollande's girlfriend is concerned, Interior Minister Claude Guéant denies everything and claims that he is the victim of slander.
Il est temps d'arrêter les pratiques d'insinuation calomnieuses, les pratiques de boule puante.
It's time to bring a halt to this throwing of political stink bombs, this practice of slanderous insinuation which is founded on nothing at all, Guéant said. A certain number of socialists have been saying that if the allegations are substantiated, they would be indignant. I share this point of view. If the allegations are substantiated, I will be indignant too. I would consider it completely unacceptable.
Ça aurait pu surgir dans l'esprit de quelqu'un.
Guéant says he himself is lodging a formal complaint for slander. One fears that in the current French presidential election campaign, it won't be the last. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
Germany's Pirate Party has become a force to be reckoned with following a regional election breakthrough in Berlin, in which the party came out of nowhere to land seats in the state parliament. Recent opinion polls show that the party enjoys nationwide support of around 8%. They were inspired by a party that emerged in Sweden 5 years ago, but have established a new identity since then. And in an effort to get their message across, Germany's pirates faced the national media in Berlin on Wednesday. Uwe Hessler was there.
German politics may be entering new and uncharted waters. This is because of the emergence of a new party called the Pirates, whose campaign pledges include greater freedom for the internet and free public transport. Their party manager is Marina Weisband, a 24-year-old psychology student.
We are the generation who grew up with the internet. It formed our way of thinking. We feel that we want to participate because we can. We want a free society, a society of knowledge and education. We want everybody to be free as long as he doesn't hurt the freedom of others. We want free information.
Membership of the Pirate Party, says Weisband, has risen sharply to about 14,000 thanks to their astonishing success in the state election in Berlin last month, in which the party captured almost 9% of the vote. At national level, they could win about 8% of the vote, according to a recent opinion poll. But the free internet agenda is not the only reason for the Pirates' popularity. Weisband claims people want more transparency and participation in political decision-making, and the Pirates' party are looking for radical solutions.
I think that major decisions have to be made on a base of basic democracy, or liquid democracy, which is even better, because not every citizen can say something about building a house, but he can say his opinion, and that's important, and he should get to say it all the time. So we need to find new solutions, and I think the major new solutions lie in the internet.
The pirate leaders say the party doesn't have a political program in the traditional sense. Instead, the membership is constantly being asked to take decisions on every upcoming political issue as it occurs. Using software called liquid feedback, party members find joint solutions that are shared by a majority. Yet in spite of such flexibility, the pirates have principles they say they don't wish to abandon. A left-leaning social policy, the protection of civil liberties, and no contact with the far right or the far left. It's the political mainstream they want to change, says Weisband.
We don't look for power in Germany. We look for change. We want to change society. We want to change the style of politics. If we have to be in the government to do that, then we will. But if the other parties change right now just because they fear us, we'd be glad to see that.
If the pirates' popularity with the German electorate persists until next general elections in 2013, the party could become the sixth political force in the national parliament, and that could indeed mean fundamental change in German politics. Uwe Hessler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
From Bonn, Germany, in the heart of Europe, you're listening to Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm your host, Matt Herrmann. In Turkey, Parliament has voted to extend by another year a mandate allowing the military to conduct cross-border operations in northern Iraq in order to chase down Kurdish rebels. The move comes one day after Turkish police arrested more than 100 people with suspected links to Kurdish rebels in three major cities. From Istanbul, Dorian Jones reports.
Prosecutors claim that over 140 people detained belong to the urban wing of the Kurdish rebel group the PKK. Among those arrested were elected mayors from across the predominantly Kurdish southeast. The detentions provoked a blistering attack by Gültan Kuşanak, joint leader of the Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party, the BDP.
Bir kez daha gözlerimizi...
This morning we opened our eyes to the news of another operation of political genocide, she said. It is clear that the government police are out to hunt Kurds. In the last 6 months, more than 5,500 people have been detained or arrested. But the government dispute the charge the probe is politically motivated. They've repeatedly cited the BDP's failure to condemn the PKK as a terrorist organisation, as evidence of its cosy ties to the Kurdish rebels. The PKK is designated as a terrorist organisation by both the EU and the US. Yasmin Çongar is deputy editor of the Turkish daily Taraf.
If you see legal members of a legal party as accomplices to an armed activity, there's not, as I said, not much way out for you as the judiciary of this country or as the government of this country.
But with thousands detained for years without trial, criticism of the crackdown is growing. Over a dozen elected mayors are now in jail. The evidence cited against the detained is also causing concern. For example, attending a PKK funeral is frequently used as proof of guilt. The EU will reportedly raise concerns over the investigation in its forthcoming annual report on Turkey. But political scientist Nuray Mert worries the arrest will further undermine efforts to end the nearly three-decade conflict with the PKK.
It fostered already existing tensions, already existing, you know, gap between Turkish public opinion and Kurdish public opinion and perception of the politics.
The latest wave of arrests comes just days after the BDP ended its boycott of parliament over the jailing of six of its parliamentary deputies, some of whom have been held as part of the probe. They returned to work on efforts to rewrite the country's military-era constitution. A new constitution is seen as key to addressing Kurdish demands and ending the PKK conflict. The Turkish Prime Minister had promised to seek a consensus on the constitution. But observers point out the latest arrests of Kurdish activists can only fuel criticism that there is a deepening divide between his government's actions and words. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
Turkey's Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has drawn a string of denials from aid institutions based here in Germany after he suggested that they were unwittingly assisting the banned Kurdish rebel group the PKK through infrastructure project funding. The German institutions say no. All their projects in Turkey, including those in eastern Kurdish regions, are mutually agreed upon with Turkish authorities. Ian Johnson has more.
Erdogan told journalists aboard a flight back to Turkey from Macedonia earlier this week
that unnamed German foundations were indirectly supporting the banned PKK. He didn't go into specifics, but his allegation rankled the many German aid institutions which have infrastructure projects in Turkey. Turkish newspapers close to Erdogan's conservative AK party indicated that his remarks were pointed at the Friedrich Ebert Foundation, an offshoot of Germany's Social Democratic Party. That was rejected as groundless by the foundation's own Istanbul bureau, which said its work was regularly audited by Turkish and German authorities. Another institution associated with Germany's Greens Party, the Heinrich Boll Foundation, rejected Erdogan's claim outright. It denied any collaboration with the PKK and said the premier intended to tar contacts the foundations have to foster dialogue across the political landscape, including elected opposition pro-Kurdish factions in eastern municipalities. While Erdogan earlier this week didn't elaborate on his allegation, Turkey's foreign minister Ahmet Davutoğlu seemed to suggest later that German institutions, when providing funds, should check out the recipients.
What the prime minister means is that terrorism is able to obtain financial support under a wide variety of labels. From the viewpoint of donors, that usually takes place unwittingly. I don't just mean the German foundations solely, but say that in very general terms. It's important, however, that a certain caution and attentiveness is shown, not just by governmental parties, but by all sides.
Turkey's largest opposition group, the Republican People's Party, or CHP, took itself to be the target of Erdogan's critique. The CHP's deputy leader, Gökhan Günaydın, rebuffed any suggestion that his party had funneled German funds to the outlawed PKK.
We call on the Prime Minister to substantiate his allegation. When a Prime Minister makes an assertion and has information about it, that money was allegedly passed on to the PKK, then he should instead ensure that the state prosecutors become active instead of loudly making accusations in an airplane to journalists. We will take legal action against this allegation.
Dr. Dufner, who heads the Heinrich Boll Foundation's Istanbul office, says her team is determined to maintain contacts across Turkey's political spectrum, including contacts, as she puts it, so that verbal interactions instead of guns speak.
If you want peaceful solution for the Kurdish issue, as we want it, and as the population in Turkey in general wants it, you need to open space for the civil, political, pro-Kurdish movements in order not to let the weapons speak like it is today.
Since the 1980s, the outlawed PKK's armed campaign for more autonomy and cultural rights for Kurds has cost some 30,000 lives. Some reforms have emerged. The Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party sits in parliament and governs eastern municipalities. But tensions, as recent events prove, remain high. Ian Johnson, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Perspectives on the news from a uniquely European point of view. You're tuned in to Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio from Bonn, Germany. The 7th International Nuremberg Human Rights Film Festival recently took place. The event brought together filmmakers from around the world in an attempt to highlight human rights issues from all corners of the globe. This year, documentaries, fiction, animated, even claymation films were on show at the festival. And the topics were just as diverse. The fight for the rights of people living with HIV, Chinese political dissidents coming up against their government, and preparations for the 2012 Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, just to name a few. Jesse Wingard went to the festival and has this report.
Nuremberg is perhaps best known in the world as the city where prominent German Nazi leaders were put on trial following the Second World War. So 60 years on, it's an appropriate setting for the biennial Nuremberg International Human Rights Film Festival. The oldest and biggest of its kind in Germany, it is different from other such film festivals, explains director Andrea Kuhn.
Many festivals in the human rights sector have a human rights background. We have a cinema background, so we put a lot of emphasis on cinematic quality of films. I'm not saying that's better, it's just where we come from, so that's our approach to filmmaking.
The week-long Human Rights Festival aims to give an overview of the state of human rights all over the world, with an array of genres and cinematic techniques used, says Andrea.
Artistic, cinematic films that really belong on a big screen in the first place. So we try to invite people and tell them, if you're interested in cinema and what's going on in the world, in the festival world, award-winning films, you have to come to our festival and watch these films. Kind of lure the people by just the high quality of the films that we screen. It's saying all kinds of films can be and are represented at our festival. So this year it ranges from a one-minute animated documentary to a four-and-a-half, very analytical, very interesting documentary from the United States, but we throw in fiction films, very high quality, more conventional, more mainstream films, as well as more experimental formats.
Whilst Hollywood blockbusters tend to be emotionally manipulative and often attempt to transport audiences to a world far away, Adlea says this film festival aims to make people more critical of what they see on the big screen.
Well, one thing that we find very important is that people understand that human rights are not an issue for those people there. Meaning, basically, you know, developed countries, third world, because that's the conception that people have in Germany, or many have. So we try to also have a focus on films that deal with issues in Germany or in Europe. So I think that's been one of the core concerns that we've had at this festival, to make sure that people understand that human rights is not somebody else's problem, it's our problem.
Spanish filmmaker Oriol Canales set about doing just that with his film Sombras, or Letters from the Shadows, which tells the story of some of the African boat people who arrive illegally each year on the Spanish coast.
At the beginning, a challenge that I didn't understand, actually, because I didn't know anything about them when I first met them. And little by little, I understood that there was a secret. They were keeping the secret of how they were living in Europe, and they didn't want to let it know to people in Africa.
It is stories like those told by Olio and the other 62 filmmakers presenting their features at the festival that seldom make it to public screenings if it weren't for events like the one in Nuremberg. It's not only mainstream media that is shunning human rights-based cinematography. It appears today's youth is also following suit. But Andrea and her team of hard-working volunteers aim to change all that.
Try to be a bit more provocative, because especially young people, or so we think, assume that human rights is nothing that concerns them. It's kind of boring. It's what their parents and teachers tell them to be concerned about, but they don't feel the impact on their own lives, and they couldn't care less. It's like unsexy as can be. To make it clear that there is no easy answer, and that to make it clear that they will not know what's coming to them if they come to the festival. Just to raise the curiosity of people and to look a bit fresher, we've added live music acts each night.
But for these 20-something-year-olds bucking the trend, the festival has certainly changed their way of thinking.
I saw some topics which I never thought about, Indonesian women working abroad for no money but a lot of harm and a lot of struggles, and that's really cool, and that's what it should be here.
I think it's actually awesome because I have the opportunity to watch movies that I would actually never watch. They are like movies that won't get into the cinemas. Here, I like in this festival, I have the opportunity to watch them. Some movies, afterwards, they have a discussion with the directors, and that's exciting for us, of course. So it's like really nice to be here.
Jesse Wingard, Deutsche Welle Radio, Nuremberg, Germany.
Keeping with film, we all know the Academy Awards. The Oscars are one of the biggest television events of the year, the movie industry's biggest prize. Okay, far from Hollywood, all the way down at the other end of the spectrum, is the market town of Hexham in Northumberland, in the northeast of England. It hosts a film awards ceremony called the Doskers, an annual film festival and awards ceremony showcasing the work of filmmakers with learning disabilities. Kevin Blackburn went to Hexham and has this report.
Live from the Kodak Theater at Hollywood and Highland, welcome to the 76th Annual Academy Award.
The annual Oscars, the glitz and glamour of Tinseltown at its best, and arguably one of the most eagerly awaited events in the motion picture industry calendar.
And the Oscar goes to Jeff Bridges in Crazy.
But sometimes film magic happens in the unlikeliest of places. The market town of Hexham in Northumberland has its own annual film award ceremony to rival the sparkle of Hollywood. It's called the Doskers and is part showcase, part prize giving for work produced by people with learning disabilities. Vicky Jones from the Holtwistle Film Project, one of the partner organisations behind the event, explains more.
The idea is that it's a sort of mixed ability festival, so it's sort of nominally is a festival for people with learning disabilities as a platform to show their film. But it's not just young people, actually anybody can enter their film. We had people there in their 60s, and there's also people who'd made films who were 17.
At this year's event, which took place in the Queen's Hall Arts Centre, more than 20 films were screened to an audience of around 250. Competition was fierce in categories such as Best Documentary, Best Animation and Best Action Film, with winners being awarded with a certificate and a chocolate Oscar. But as Vicky Jones says, winning a prize isn't the main reason the ceremony takes place.
To showcase work that people have done that might not otherwise get seen by anyone else apart from their group, to have a sense of watching a film with lots of people, I mean, I think that's one of the things that's really exciting about it. And thirdly, to see your film on a big screen. We so much often watch everything on computer screens and everything now, but to see it on a big screen in a huge blacked out theatre with 200 people there, hopefully clapping at it at the end, is something else.
Come along, Peter.
Are we going to the Mr. McGuinness Garden again to get carrots?
Scooping the prize for Best Animation was 22-year-old Carol Nichols' grisly short The Terrible Tale of Peter Rabbit, a gory version of the classic Beatrix Potter story.
It wasn't like the happy tale that Beatrix Potter did, it was like a dark tale where bunnies got murdered and put into pies. It took a long time to actually get it all made and filmed, about a year. Something I'd never really done before, so I wanted to give it a go. It won Best Animation. It's quite nerve-wracking and exciting at the same time. Well, there's going to be a Peter Rabbit part two, so concentrate on that.
Make me a lot of pie, woman.
No, do it yourself.
Peter Watson, one of the practitioners at Dilston College, the local further education institute run by the charity MenCap, thinks an event like the Doskers is important to change public perception of what people with learning disabilities can achieve.
I think the danger with people with learning disabilities particularly is that people underestimate what they're able to do. Rather than seeing people with learning disabilities as passive recipients of help, it shows people with learning disabilities as having a kind of agency in the sort of work they're doing and able to be integrated in the wider society. In the nature of filmmaking, people can kind of find the level at which they're able to function with sensitive support from the filmmakers.
Peter is also convinced that having rural Northumberland as a base, far from being a disadvantage, is actually key to the success of some of the film work which has been produced.
I think of it as a creative space. The sort of people I trained with at university are sitting around in cafes in Soho waiting for someone to hand them a big pile of money to make films, and up here in the north we're just picking up film cameras and going and doing it. And that, to me, that's kind of liberation. It's not sitting around waiting for somebody to decide you can make a film.
Plans are currently afoot to expand the Doskers award ceremony to include films produced by groups working with people with learning disabilities from across the entire northeast region. And it seems that filmmaking, far from being exclusive and difficult, is the perfect outlet to engage people at different levels of ability. But if you're still a little nervous about getting involved, then award-winning filmmaker Claire Hodgson has a word of advice.
Just follow their dreams. Just give it a go. Don't be scared.
Gavin Blackburn, Deutsche Welle Radio, Hexham.
That is all for this edition of Newslink. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you tune in again tomorrow. I'm Matt Herman. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the programme. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.